Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Glory, glory, Tottenham Hotspur! Glory, glory, Tottenham Hotspur. Glory, glory, Tottenham Hotspur. And the Spurs go marching on.
Welcome to Hometown Glory, your Spurs and culture podcast. I'm Charlie and thrilled to be joined by one of the UK's most exciting young broadcasters, Abby Summers. Now, Abby is everywhere right now. You'll have seen and heard her on Sky Sports, Talk Sports, DR Sport, Haters, Premier League TV, all the while representing her beloved Tottenham Hotspur. Abby, welcome to Hometown Glory and thank you so much for coming on. How are you?
Oh, my absolute pleasure, Charlie. I've been so excited to come on this with you. I'm so proud of like what you've created here. I love it.
Oh, thank you very much. We're really excited by our little podcast. Like I said, we're thrilled to have you on. We're big fans. Now, tell us a little bit about yourself, Abby. How did your broadcasting career start out, for example?
Do you know what? It's a bit weird because I never went to uni. I didn't get like a typical degree or anything like that. I left school at like 17. And I remember writing to a company called Team Talk, which was in Leeds, and it was like an affiliate of Sky. I actually don't know if they're still going or not. I should actually check that out. But basically, when I left school, they offered me like an internship for like a month to go up and work with them in Leeds. So I did. I lived in like a hotel for a month and it was really cool and I learned so much stuff. So did a bit on the radio side at Sky and then obviously a lot of journalism stuff, which is kind of where I started out. Even though actually the writing side of it, I'm not that good at, I'll be honest with you. Leaving school at 17, that probably doesn't help. But yeah, that was kind of how I started out. And then all the while just, you know, had a full-time job, just been working. You know how like life kind of gets in the way and you push your dreams to like the side. There were things I wanted to like accomplish personally, which I did. And then COVID happened. Some things have gone on in my life and it kind of made me like reevaluate like what I wanted to do with my own life and thought to myself, you know, you should be backing yourself because you've got passion for it. You're talented at, you know, presenting and you've got a really good amount of knowledge, but you know, especially within football. So I kind of just thought to myself, you know, go full steam ahead, give it everything and see where it takes you. And I've had an amazing 2021, touch wood for 2022, that it just continues to, you know, go from strength to strength.
Has it been challenging? I mean, you spoke about it's been quite a sort of long and winding road to reach where you are. Do you feel like it's been a challenge to reach this stage?
Yeah, definitely. I think that, you know, you get a lot of knockbacks and setbacks, especially like in such a competitive industry. And you have to be really, really dedicated. Like I've given up a lot of things in the last kind of like year and a half to focus on it. Friendships really have taken a backseat, relationships, things like that. You really just have to be fully dedicated and you don't get a lot of time. And, you know, things won't always go your way, but I'm a big believer in that if something is meant for you, it will happen. And just be positive and give good energy out to the world and manifest. Like there's a lot, people might think I'm insane, but I'm really into this whole manifestation thing and I believe in it. And that, you know, it's like power of attraction. So like if you want to achieve something and you put it out there, if you want it enough and you work hard enough, it will come back to you, you know, in some way, shape or form, if it's meant for you. So there's been lots of challenges, but I think that every setback you have or every criticism you have, I think for me personally, just spurs me on just to kind of go again and like work harder and achieve what I want to achieve and prove people wrong.
Could you work a bit harder at manifesting a trophy perhaps for Spurs, Abby?
I mean, I'm not a miracle worker, right?
And tell me, I feel like the challenge of being a woman in football is often spoken about, and it's often, I was listening to something Max Rushton in The Guardian put out recently about sort of misogyny in football, you know, the challenges that not just women working in football, but even sort of female supporters are still encountering just to, you know, support their football teams. Is this something you've experienced in trying to sort of make it in football broadcasting?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, you always get people, whether it's on Twitter or to your face, on any, also kind of any social media platform, if you're doing well, there's always a troll that wants to try and bring you down. And that person can just be sitting in their living room doing absolutely nothing with their life. And they'll say, oh, well, she's only doing that because of the way she looks, or she must be sleeping with someone and this and that. And, it, you know, you would never have that said to you if you're a man. So why is it impossible that a woman can just work really, really hard and be talented and have the same job or strive for the same things that a man wants to achieve? I've never personally found at football games in particular, you know, that much misogyny. I've never personally noticed it a lot. You know, I've been going since I was 8 years old, and thankfully I've never really encountered that. You know, you get obviously the few looks here and there, but like nothing ever as much as it is on social media. But I just, for me, I've learned to just ignore people on social media. I don't, you know, engage with people that I think are negative. I'll happily just block them straight away. I don't care what they have to say. You know, if their opinion was important to me, I would care. But, you know, I don't care about some weirdo sitting at home behind a keyboard. And I think that's what I've had to learn in the last kind of year or so, because you do get haters. But I think if you're doing something right, you're always going to get people that just want to tear you down. So I just think of it as, great, the more people that dislike me, probably means I'm doing something that they're just jealous of me doing. But I think that it is difficult as a woman to break into this type of industry when it's so male dominant. And I think that you have to prove yourself twice as much in terms of your knowledge, in terms of your, you know, intelligence on the topics and things like that. There's many men that comment on football that have never played the game just as much as women. But somehow that doesn't seem to get called out. And I think that is unfair. But we see so many incredible broadcasters. I work with, you know, amazing young people coming up in the industry. A good friend of mine, Pippa, she's, you know, really breaking into the industry as well. And, you know, we both would probably say the same thing. You have to work 10 times harder, but then the reward is 10 times bigger.
It's interesting you talk about social media. I feel like it's both, you know, an extraordinary tool to have in your kind of arsenal as a, you know, as a young broadcaster, young journalist, sort of young person looking to break into football or whatever it is, really. But also, like you say, it's sort of fraught with danger and trolls and hideous stuff as well. How have you managed to sort of navigate those choppy waters as you've sort of gone through everything?
It used to really get to me, I'll be honest, it really did. And I'm not someone that really cares about people's opinions. Like, I'm quite confident and strong-willed in that sense. But, you know, earlier this year, when I got a really big opportunity with Sony Sports in India, and I was really excited, and it was during lockdown, and I was lucky enough that I got to go to a few games and cover the FA Cup first. And, you know, it's incredible, because there'll be 100 really nice comments, but one comment that is just, you know, so unnecessary. And actually, it was coming from a woman, which, you know, was even worse, a woman who I don't know, you know, again, just probably jealous. But you just have to learn to block it out. And it did really upset me, because I had personal stuff going on at the time. And I just, you know, when you're juggling that plus all your workload and you're just trying to be the best you are and seize kind of like the opportunity, you don't need someone telling you, you know, this, that in your ear and making people, you know, think that that's your character and people judge you in that way. But I learned over time, there's nothing you can do. People are always going to say what they want to say about you. If you don't know them, why do you care? Just keep doing you. You've got your friends, you know who you are. If someone wants to say something about your character, what you're doing, how you got there, fine. It's no business of mine. That's on them, no problem at all. So I think I've actually learned from those experiences, and I actually want to thank those people that were, you know, really unnecessarily disgusting about me and to me, because it's just made me better probably as a broadcaster. It's made me realize not to get involved with petty things on social media, and just to take the high road, because all they want to do is see you fail, and all they want to do is see you bite back. So it's actually taught me just to, you know, remain cool, calm, collected, not be so hot-headed probably, and just ignore it. And I think that when you don't care about people's opinions in that sense, they can't get you, and that's what probably annoys them more, that you won't retaliate.
That's spectacularly good advice, actually, Abby. Thank you for going through that in such good detail. Now, another thing I wanted to talk to you about is your experience working across two quite different sort of styles of sort of modern media, if you like, in the sense that you've got your kind of traditional media, the sort of, you know, long-standing broadcasters, you know, outlets that have been around for ages that do things in quite a quite a traditional way. And then you've also got experience working for the more sort of disruptive, innovative, often fan-led online outlets. How have you found that landscape changing? Because I feel like it's at the centre of a lot of, you know, people have opinions on this, I feel like, in terms of how football is covered and, you know, the different styles of which it's done, the sort of fan TV stuff, etc., is something that always causes a lot of chat. How have you found working across the two different styles?
They're both very, very different. Very different. You know, it's great when you get to work for a channel which is, you know, established and things like that. And, you know, we've grown up watching those various channels and how they are very suited, if that's a good word, men in suits and everything like that. And we love that. And that's what, you know, they're there for. And that's kind of what they've built an audience on. And I like working with channels like that because it allows you to be professional and probably hone in on your skills as a broadcaster and things like that. You can really showcase your knowledge. And of course, they have a massive audience as well. But equally, working for, you know, kind of YouTube outlets and things like that. And bear in mind, I'm not a content creator. I've never been someone that does YouTube or fan cams or vlogging. That's not really my bag. So when I kind of got into this world about 6 months ago, I had absolutely no idea the reach that these YouTube channels get, you know, and it is absolutely insane. And they actually reach far more audience on occasions than, you know, your mainstream TV channels do, which is absolutely insane to me. And how many people have built their career from a YouTube platform is also amazing. Credit to those people, because it's really, really hard work that goes into getting your subscribers and things like that on YouTube. And I really commend everyone that does that. I love working on the YouTube side of things and those kind of independent channels, because you get to also be yourself. You can showcase your personality, your opinions, things like that. And even though obviously you try and be as professional as possible, well, I do anyway, in you know, the channels and the shows that I host, but it allows you more freedom and you can speak openly and you can have your own critiques of players and things like that, whereas probably on the more mainstream things you just have to be more by the book. But I think it's good if you've got experience in doing both, because mainstream TV, I feel, is now trying to be more current, and that involves a lot of the YouTube world. You see some companies trying to, you know, bridge the gap between the suits and the young, you know, the young people now. So you see a bit of a crossover, which doesn't always make sense in certain situations, but it's nice because it does give people an opportunity to be on that as well. So I enjoy doing both. They are really, really different. But I think that if you can do both and you can learn both sides of it, you're probably actually better off, because you've got a good balance and you know how to do both in what situation and read it well. There's so many amazing creators that come through YouTube, and I'm really lucky that I get to work with loads of them. And I'm happy that they get the recognition now, you know, whether that be through a YouTube outlet and things like that, because they really do create such incredible shows. You know, even you guys, you know, you've decided to start Hometown Glory, which I absolutely love. And there's so many other, you know, from a Spurs perspective, there's so many other amazing creators that have launched their own YouTube channels, you know, like Patrick Tyrant, Holly Agomba, you know, Max. There's so many good creators, and I love that YouTube gives people a platform that can do that.
Absolutely. We couldn't agree more. So my last question on you and your career before we launch into our Spurs 7 questions, Abby, what's the dream gig for you, do you reckon? What would you love to end up doing?
I really love radio at the moment. I've always been more of like TV orientated, but the more I'm doing radio, the more I absolutely love it. I kind of like to just be able to dabble on both, you know, maybe have my own show on a network, you know, on a radio network, post on a sports channel for, you know, amazing moments, Champions League final, things like that. So that's where I'm working to, but I'm just really happy at the moment I get to be involved in this industry and things are working well. So wherever I'm meant to be in the end, it will take me to, and whatever platform I'm meant to be on and things like that. But I really do love the radio side of it at the moment. It's literally like being on a podcast. So I think we're all quite well versed in those. So it's good. My experience on those is definitely helping me.
Yeah, I think it's quite hard these days to find someone that's not either like hosting a podcast or is appearing on a podcast. So yeah, we're all We're all way too experienced. Right, that feels like an excellent point to jump into our world famous hometown glory, Spurs 7. So these are the questions we feel that cover the true Tottenham Hotspur fan experience and all its grief and all its glory. Abby, you're our first special guest who's not a Spurs legend. I mean, you know, maybe at some point you will be considered a Spurs legend. Who's to say? But as of right now, you're not Gary Mabbutt, Michael Dawson or Jenna Scalacci, who have been our first three special guests on the show. So I'm really intrigued to hear your answers as more of a fan. So here we go. Question one. I would like to know your Spurs origin story, please. How did you end up being a Spurs fan?
Oh, well, for my sins, I became a Spurs fan because my dad is from Edmonton, so obviously right next door to Tottenham. My grandpa on my mum's side was actually an East End boy, but supported Spurs. And yeah, that's actually kind of how I didn't really get a choice in the matter, to be fair. So I just kind of obviously fell into the fact I had to support Tottenham. That was, you know, just a given. And the way I fell in love with football actually wasn't through Spurs, funnily enough, it was through England. And I remember watching England, thinking must have been, could only have been young, maybe like 6 or 7 or something like that in a tournament. And I just remember loving England. And I'd be like, oh, my God, I love football so much. Like, this is so cool, little six-year-old me. And then my dad was like, OK, we'll get, you know, we've got a season ticket anyway. So we'll just come to, you know, you'll come to Spurs with me. And I was like, great. And then that was kind of it from then. I started going when I was like 8 years old. And I've never actually looked back since. So always me and my dad. There is a big group of us that, like, we all kind of, like, sit together and we go, like, away games and things like that. Obviously, I don't get to do that many away games anymore. Just because of work. But yeah, there's about 20 of us that all go together and we've all kind of like, all the kids, like we've all grown up together, which is so lovely. You know, we've been going to football together since we were so young. Like, I remember some of them, they're like grown up now, they're like 18, 19. And I was like 6 years older than them at the time. And I'm like, oh my God, I've literally watched you grow up at football, which is so nice and so weird because I feel really old at that point. But yeah, it's that's literally how I got into football and how I got into Spurs. There was no other team I was obviously going to be allowed to support. And I guess, you know, I've seen quite a bit of success, I guess, you know, growing up. It's more than maybe some other people could say they have, older generations. I guess I've seen us win the Carling Cup. I've seen us, you know, play Champions League, some of the biggest nights. But again, you just want more, don't you? You just want more from your team. You want to see and feel and experience, you know, the highest level and winning something. So maybe in our lifetime, Charlie, we'll see it. Maybe.
Do you remember your first game?
I get asked this quite a lot, and I've got an awful memory, and I can never remember if it's Nottingham Forest or if it's Blackburn. I can never remember because it was before I got my season ticket that I went to my first game. So again, I think I probably was about 6 or 7 because I must have gone with someone when I was little, and I can never.
I mean, that's really young. That's really young to start going regularly.
Exactly. So I really don't remember my first game well. I do remember that I think we drew. Okay. And it was around Christmas time, so I actually think it might have been Forest, but I can never remember. And I tried to like Google it and find the fixture, and I can never find it. I can never find it. But I was really young, and I've been going for such a long time.
So
I can never remember my first game. I really can never remember it. Maybe I forgot about it intentionally, pushed it right to the back of my brain because we were so bad. 6 year old me.
What was the first kind of Spurs team? What era would you say was when, you know, you were going regularly and sort of really got the bug?
How old would I have been? Well, if I got my season ticket when I was 8. So I guess that would be 2000 and... I'm not trying to work out when I was born. that would be around like 2002, 2003 time, probably. I mean, yeah, 2002, 2003 time. So like the Defoes, the Keynes,
yeah,
the Berbatovs, obviously Ledley. Yeah, that kind of era. Yeah, from what I can
remember. There are a lot of very likable players. I feel like you know, we spoke to Michael Dawson about this, that, you know, once Martin Yole came in, you know, what, 2005, around then, I feel like Spurs started to become fun again.
Yeah, it did. And I remember I loved Martin Yole, absolutely loved Martin Yole. I remember being at that game where they sacked him and he didn't even know. And I remember thinking, this is so out of order. And I remember him crying. I remember that video of him driving out of the old gates of the West End after he got sacked. After we got home, I was like, oh my God, it's so sad. I'm not going to see Martin Yeo anymore. This is what happens when you take your young daughter to football. It gets really emotional really early. But yeah, I think that was kind of like the team. I mean, I grew up absolutely obsessed with Jermaine Defoe. I make no secret of it. He was my idol growing up. And then obviously he moved to Portsmouth and it broke my heart. And I'll never forget when he came back and that was like the most amazing moment for me ever. I literally told him, we did an interview during lockdown and I was like, I have knickers that say Defoe on the bum and I'm proud of it. They're never worn. I always wanted to meet you so you could sign them. He's like, sure, I'll sign them for you. So yeah, that's a weird story for you. Really weird story for you right there.
There you go. That's. I feel like it's best I don't add anything to that, to that story. And so, I mean, at school, I always feel like, I mean, I was surrounded by like tons of Arsenal fans at school, and I'm a wee bit older than you, so it was a terrible time to be a Spurs fan, as it was like peak sort of Wenger years. Spurs terrible, Arsenal incredible. How were you sort of outnumbered at school? Were you a very sort of proud, like always sticking up for your team at school, that kind of fan?
Oh yeah, literally. I'd always have my Spurs shirt with me, like especially at secondary school. Actually, I was like one of those really annoying girls that just was always with the boys talking about football. But yeah, I was very, very proud about it. Primary school, yeah, I remember there being a lot of United supporters, a lot of Arsenal supporters, which is probably like now you probably get loads of Chelsea and loads of City fans as like a kind of reverse. But yeah, I remember being really proud. There was always like a few Spurs fans, just to like kind of where I live. But
yeah.
Yeah, it was always very Arsenal dominant, you know, just like kind of end like the Invincibles and things like that. Disgraceful. Obviously, United were literally winning everything at that point as well. So that was really fun. But when I got to like secondary school, obviously we had like Martin Yeo kind of at that. Martin Yeo was still there, Harry Redknapp. So like things were obviously getting a little bit better and you could kind of argue back a little bit more. But I was always like really proud of it. I always had like Spurs everything, like Spurs pencil case, Spurs this, Spurs that, Spurs coat. Like I was that child. I remember when I got my first car when I was, 17? And I remember had like, you remember like the bumper stickers?
Yeah.
The Spurs shop used to do a pack of like 6 bumper stickers. Obviously for you to not put all 6 on your car at one time like I did. And I remember my car got keyed so many times. My dad used to go mental at me. He used to be like, why is your car being keyed again? And I was like, it's because I've got Spurs dye, Spurs this, Spurs that. 7 bumper stickers in the car as well. I've got a Carl Walker air freshener, this and that. I was that child. So I was very, very proud. I always am proud, you know. Even however bad we are, I try and defend them. I feel like I'm quite realistic with it. But,
yeah,
you know,
I feel like supporting Spurs, you know, in the sort of, even the recent times, you know, when we've been relatively good, we've still been trophyless. So I think you have to accept a level of like self-deprecation. You have to own what Tottenham is. Otherwise, you know, social media and any sort of conversation with friends can get pretty miserable quite quickly.
I think that's
stands
exactly
in good step.
If you're just realistic with it, you know, someone will go, oh, but Spurs are shit. It's like, yeah, I know. Like no one's saying that we're not, you know, no one's saying we've achieved anything, you know, but I'm just saying, I accept that. So you can't hurt me because I already know it.
And I think this is what I feel. I'm always quite proud of Spurs fans for having this level of like, we know what we are. You can't, like you say, you can't hurt us because we are completely self-aware. We're not perhaps like other fan bases who have. And I think this is partly because we've had to grow up watching Arsenal literally go a season unbeaten. We've watched Chelsea win the Champions League. We've watched United clean up. We've watched City become this, you know, terrifying power.
We've seen Liverpool have a complete resurgence.
Exactly. So we've grown up to appreciate, you know, whatever good stuff does come our way. And I think, you know, the agonising thing is always that we feel like we're just there and never quite do it. But that's also quite a good life lesson as well.
Oh my God. They literally teach you to handle disappointment in any walk of life. I'm 100% certain if it wasn't for Spurs, I wouldn't be as good at handling disappointment and also hiding it.
I could not agree more. I mean, I wonder if like it nets out as like a positive sometimes, be supporting Spurs to the degree I do. But I think ultimately, you know, it does set you up for how largely disappointing life can be.
It does. It really
does. This is going quite bleak. This wasn't the intention.
We can take the positives from it, but it's taught us a good life lesson, hasn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Let's move on to something a bit jollier now. Your all-time favourite Spurs player, please.
Oh my God, my all-time favourite. Well, like I said, Jermaine Defoe was my childhood favourite. He was my absolute favourite. I'd say up until the summer, Harry Kane was probably a strong contender. Look, he still is, to be fair. I still think Harry Kane is, iconic for Spurs. I know that he's having an absolutely awful season for various reasons.
Do you think you'll get over it this summer? Do you think it will... Has that kind of forever tarnished your relationship, do you think?
I think a lot of fans feel that way, to be fair. I don't think I'm alone in saying it. I think that it's... What's that saying? That it takes, years to build a reputation and seconds to destroy it. And I think that he's been a fantastic servant to Spurs. I don't necessarily think his form is completely reliant on what happened in the summer. I don't think that at all. We're 4 months on since the transfer window shut. I just think that things can sometimes be handled in a better way. And I think that when you are such an iconic figure, you could have a stand named after you, essentially, one day. I think that it does tarnish it a little bit and it leaves a bit of a sour taste. Maybe if he'd gone on and had a really good season, then people wouldn't have thought about it. But because we're still not playing really well and he's still not playing that great, I think that's why it kind of hangs over you. But look, he's still one of my favourite players, just to take that bitterness out of it. Still one of my favourite players, Robbie Keane. I absolutely loved him. Hated when he went to Liverpool. Glad it didn't work out and he came back. Ledley King, of course. Michael Dawson. Oh my God, I love Michael Dawson. What a great guy he is. I think it's really close between Moussa Dembele and Jan Vertonghen for me.
Jan's probably mine. I mean, Jürgen's like my sort of, when I was little, he was my, oh my God, I can't believe this guy plays for Spurs favourite. But in terms of longevity and the just impeccable service that he provided, I think Jan's always my favourite.
Yeah, I think Moussa Dembele for me was incredible. And I think that showed you as soon as he left, we literally just went straight downhill. Mm. Despite a steady downward spiral, it was like, wow, he's gone. I think with Jan, it kills me he never got a proper sending off, because I think that he really deserved it for the loyalty he showed to that club. He definitely deserved to win a trophy with that club, and I'm always going to be so devastated that he didn't. He was such a leader, and I think that's what we actually lack massively now as well. I'll probably go Jan Vertonghen, and I really was absolutely devastated when he left. And I remember that game that he, I can't remember when he got subbed off, but he came off.
Southampton in the car.
Was it Southampton? And he was walking around the pitch, and you when you just know it's over, and he was kind of crying on the bench, and you could just see he just wasn't at the level anymore to be playing, Premier League or that type of intensity of football. And I just remember thinking so sorry, that this has come to an end, because there'd been such an iconic partnership, him and Toby, and Jan still always edged it for me. And I think we also, I feel as amazing as Toby was, and he really was an amazing defender for us, you saw even Davinson Sanchez come in alongside Jan Vertonghen, and even, Jan made Davinson Sanchez look pretty seamless that season. So the way he actually managed to kind of coach whoever was next to him, I think is also really telling of the type of leader and player he was as well, and how important he was for Spurs. So, yeah, I think I'd probably go Jan Vertonghen. But Moussa Dembele is a very close second, because I really just loved watching Moussa Dembele. And I think that he probably is one of the most underrated Premier League players. If he would have been at a Chelsea, a City, somewhere like that, he'd have got so many more plaudits. And you just have to look at all the players that play with him, and they all say Moussa Dembele is the best player they've played with or, against is impossible. So, yeah, for me, close between them two, but I'll go Jan Vertonghen.
I'm thrilled you've said Jan. I've been waiting for someone to say Jan. And it pains me watching us now playing with a back three when you think about how good he would be as the left-sided centre-back. I still think he could do a perfectly decent job in a back three, particularly where he doesn't have to do quite as much running.
Yeah, maybe so.
But was clearly one of those just thoroughly decent guys as well. Everyone I've ever spoken to that's worked with him or interviewed him or been around him just talks about how thoughtful and generous and cultural and cultured rather, thoroughly fantastic individual that Yeah, so sad we never got to say goodbye to him properly. I hope he comes back.
I'm sure he'll be back. I'm sure he'll do the Toby thing
that Toby did the other week, I'm sure, at some point.
I'm sure.
He strikes me as well as someone that will definitely go into coaching. And my dream is like for some sort of Jan, Musa, like managerial, maybe Christian as well.
Imagine like a Jan, Musa, Toby, Ericsson, full managerial like combo. Imagine how good that would be.
Could you start manifesting that immediately?
I'm actually gonna start manifesting it. As soon as we get off this call, I'm gonna actually start manifesting that for like the next like 10 years. Because imagine how good that would be. We'd have such a solid defence, we'd have someone who actually could, you know, do something in midfield, and then we'd have someone that actually could create, you know, make things happen. What a vision. Really good from you, Charlie. I like that manifestation.
Good. Right, next question. This is probably my favourite question that we ask people. And I'm excited to ask someone that's not a former Spurs player, because I feel like the Spurs legends are always a bit coy about answering this one. Your favourite terrible Spurs player? And I feel like this is something that Spurs fans hold very close, these types. You know, they might be sort of low talent, high, you know, high application types that always give their, you know, give their all but are basically awful. It might be the sort of strikers that do absolutely nothing for 89 minutes but then pop up with some incredible goal. It might be the player that for some inexplicable reason you've defended blindly on social media for years and years and years into your friendship group, etc. Who is yours, please?
Do you know what? There's a lot of...
There's a lot.
There's really a lot. My worst ever... I mean, do you remember Gilberto? He was absolutely terrible. I think he played literally once, didn't he, for us in the Europa League.
Remember he scored against West Ham, I seem to remember. We beat West Ham like 4-0 once and he looked quite good. And it was like, oh, wow, maybe this guy's pretty decent. He was awful.
There's a lot of really poor ones like Gregor Rezniak, like Dumitrescu. There's actually loads, like, as I'm thinking. Soldado was awful. I don't really remember like defending him though. Lewis Holtby, for me, I had really high hopes for. I really liked Lewis Holtby. And I probably kept thinking Lewis Holtby would come good and never did. He's probably one of them.
There was a lot of fanfare around him when he arrived. I seem to remember us, like, we'd signed him and he was supposed to join in the summer. And then we, like, paid a little bit extra for him to arrive in the January window. And I remember thinking, ah, here's finally this guy that's going to, like, help bail out because you've finally got a bit of creativity and it's not going to be all on Gareth to do everything. And I seem to remember him, like, playing against Norwich or something, looking half decent and getting quite excited, but just nothing.
Oh, wait, what about like, I mean, more recently, what about like GK and Kudu? Like, they made that whole thing about like a 5-minute long video for him, didn't they?
I mean, we made him live in a travel lodge for like 3 months or something, didn't we?
Yeah. And they literally like announced it as if like we'd signed Messi and we'd signed this little kid that like literally no one had heard of and he was absolutely terrible. Clinton and Jai, oh my God, I'm just thinking about these people and I'm like, oh my God, they actually played. David Bentley was awful. Bar the Arsenal goal. Do you know what? It's a really, really difficult question to just pick one. Benjamin Stambouli, terrible. Maybe like Paulinho, because maybe I thought, I think I thought Paulinho would actually be like quite good. I remember him scoring against Cardiff. Like the
back heel,
The back heel. And I remember maybe thinking like Paulinho might be good. I think I probably defended like Nasser Chadli quite a bit as well. I think I probably thought Chadli was quite good. Chadli wasn't bad.
No.
He definitely wasn't the worst person we've signed. It's a really hard question because there's so many to just pick one. I'm giving you like a buffet of options here.
I'm getting like gout from how many rich, terrible footballers you're serving up.
Do you know what? I can't narrow it down to just one for you, but there's a large assortment there that I've backed. Do you know what? This is going to be really harsh, actually. I've backed Harry Winks a lot.
Okay.
Did be really controversial. I've backed Harry Winks a lot. And I really thought that Harry Winks would keep turning it around. And I'm now safe to say that Harry Winks, I don't believe, will turn it around for Tottenham. I think that he maybe for another club he'll be okay, but I don't think for Spurs. So I could go out on a limb and say he's definitely not the worst, but I'd say that that's someone I've probably given a lot of faith into over the years, and it's not been repaid.
So even this sort of mini renaissance he seems to be having under Conte, have you drawn a line under Winks now?
He did pass the ball forward last night. And I literally could not believe it. I said to whoever's next to me, I was like, remember where you were when you saw him play a decent ball forward as well. But yeah, I think that he's quite a Conte-style player. He's got that like low centre of gravity, I guess. And he is quite passionate. But I just don't think that... I can't see him turning it around.
He seems to fit a number of players that we have that you just feel at this point just... move to a different club and start fresh.
Yeah,
and
sometimes you just need a fresh start, I think.
Yeah, I think obviously most people would think Dele falls into that category as well, where it's just becoming a bit painful and upsetting. And I think we have quite a lot of affection for these players and you essentially just want, you know, good things for them. And I feel like for me, Dele's one where you're just like, I don't think this is going to happen now. Please just go and like fulfill your potential somewhere where you can be happy again. It's like being in a sort of, you know, a bad toxic relationship and you just want the best for that person.
I totally agree with you. I think that we've, you know, kind of flogged the Dele thing to death. I think it's just not going to work. I think that for every party, we just need to all go our separate ways. Maybe he'll be good, you know, for another team. I see him at like a Southampton and Everton. I also think he'd be like a marquee signing for someone like a Newcastle. I think, you know, obviously he's not going to fancy going there as they're going to get relegated.
Let's keep going. Your match day rituals, Abby. So do you like go to the same pub when you're going to the stadium? Do you have any lucky clothes? Do you get really nervous? Like what? Tell me about the sort of match day experience for you.
Match experience for me, as I've got older, I don't get there that early anymore. I'm more like an in and out kind of girl now. I hate to break it to everyone. Me and my dad used to get there quite early and like have something to eat, like Bill Nick, and like go there beforehand and things like that. But now more like get to the ground, kind of go in. I see some of my friends. Sometimes I go downstairs by like where the fish and chip bit is. Mm-hmm. That's where everyone seems to congregate in the new stadium. Go down there, like have a drink, go upstairs if I'm there like half an hour before, which is nice. Other than that, it's usually in and straight out as soon as, you know, the whistle goes. I like to get home, have as much sleep as possible, get out cold. I'm terrible. I'm absolutely terrible in the winter. I am so, so cold all the time. So no amount of layers and clothing is ever enough for me. And I'm, you know, like the Michelin man who like walks around like that, like a huge like blow up guy. That's me in the winter. I've got like a pair of tights on, a pair of leggings on, a pair of jeans on. You know, like four tops on, and then a jacket, a scarf, hat, everything. I like really go for it, like multiple layers of socks. So in the winter, I'm less inclined to like hang around. Match day rituals, clothing. I used to be like really superstitious on things. So if I went to a game in a specific outfit, I'd have to wear that same outfit until we lost. And it was really difficult remembering what socks you wore, that exact pair, what knickers you wore, what bra you wore, what top you wore. Like, and I genuinely did this for years. Like, it was obviously when I was a bit younger. I say a bit younger, I still did it, like, even in Champions League, because I started to get more superstitious again. But, yeah, I used to do it like that. I used to make sure I had the exact outfit and keep wearing it until we lost. And then when we lost, I'd have a whole new outfit, nothing to do with the old one, and do the same thing again. But I don't really do that as much now. I have got a pair of socks that say lucky, they say lucky Spurs on them, and they've got a cockerel on.
And that's pretty on the nose in terms of like lucky clothes. Do you get nervous before matches? Have those nerves sort of evolved as you've gotten a bit older? Like, are you as stressed out about it now? Particularly, I think as someone that works sort of within the industry, you know, I know a lot of people who, particularly if you're working quite closely to the club you support, it can alter, you know, how you support that team. And, you know, you sort of see like kind of the fourth wall is revealed and you actually see how football works and you see how your sort of beloved club works, and it can sometimes change things. Have you found that?
Yeah, I definitely don't get nervous anymore. I don't actually like Derby Day in particular. I don't like Derby Day. Don't enjoy anything about it. I just want it to
be over. In what way?
Just because I don't, like, not so much with, like, Chelsea, but it's more like with Arsenal. Like, I just can't, because I don't rate Arsenal at all anymore. It's more like I just don't want them to get one over on us because I don't. I know that we're poor, but I think they're even worse at times. Not at the moment, but I think they're even worse at times. So I just don't enjoy North London Derby because you get all these people like going off on your phone and your texts and things like that. And I just think, oh, like leave it out. I don't enjoy Derby Day that much. I enjoy when it's over, to be fair. I don't enjoy the game really at all. Because always like form goes out the window in Derby. So like, you know, if we're banging form and then we play Arsenal, we usually don't actually put on the type of performance I'd like us to actually play and get the result I'd like us to get. It's very rare. But I don't get nervous anymore. I used to get really nervous for games. I think they're working so much in that industry. I've had to like be professional in certain things. So like, I can't show that I'm nervous. So I've just kind of like pushed it back in my mind. The last time I felt sick nervous was the Champions League final. That was the last, and like those Champions League games. I don't get nervous like Premier League games anymore. Cup games, maybe if they're like of some importance, but I don't even remember feeling that in like the Carabao Cup final, you know, last season. I don't remember feeling that either. But yeah, I think the only time I used to get in really, really bad moods when we lost. And then I think what happened was is that we kept losing. So I had to obviously find a way to deal with it. And I remember we lost to Southampton. It was like 2019. It was that season we just kept losing away from home. In that last 10 months of Poch. And I remember we lost to Southampton. And I remember just sitting on the stairs in my house and being like head in my hands. And I just was like, I'm actually going to lose my shit if I don't like calm down. And I think we were a 3 o'clock kickoff. It was only 5:30. And I went straight to bed. I literally put myself to bed. And I think I had plans that night. And I was like, I'm not coming. I was like, I'm in the worst mood, literally not coming out. Went straight to bed, woke up next day, was okay. And the only time since then I've had a mood like that properly was against United, the Nuno's last game.
Yeah,
I hadn't let myself get to that state. I'd really tried to like control it and not care anymore, but I was absolutely livid with that United game. Livid. And then the hour and a half worth of traffic after probably put it on top of it. And I was just in the most horrendous mood for 2 days, two days until we sat Nuno.
I sort of felt like there might be a greater good that came from that United game. So I don't know if I was as bleak feeling as I would be normally losing 3-0 at home. I think the Chelsea 3-0 before that, a few weeks before, I was like, that was just so, that was just like pure misery, because to watch a rival like that just be so much better than us was really tough. It's really interesting you mentioned that Southampton game, because I remember I was away with my wife and young daughter at the time. Well, she was young at the time and still is young. I don't know why I keep saying young. And we were away on a little weekend and we were about to drive back. And I just remember seeing the score come in, having seen that we were 1-0 up, weren't we? And it was all
going fine.
And it was a real, like, we kind of, it felt like we absolutely needed to get something from that game to stay in the top four, or for the top four to be on. And yeah, we just conceded like two ridiculous goals. I remember like
quick succession as well.
Yeah, and like Danny Rose like was at fault for one of them, and I love Danny, and it felt like a lot of these players were on their last legs. It was just, it was awful. And I remember just being in such a bad mood on the drive home. It was a really long drive back from the Lake District. And I just remember feeling like, I'm going to like ruin this experience for like my wife and my daughter. It's one of our first holidays as a family. I have to like snap out of this. It's just so pathetic.
And it's and so think, difficult to do that though. It's like when someone goes, it's only a game. How much does that irritate you when someone says it's only a game?
It's the worst. And I think it's the worst because you know it's true as well. And like, it's a bit like being a sort of a robot that becomes sentient, and you're like, I'm aware of how like ridiculous this is, but there's nothing I can do about it. I'm like afflicted with this ridiculous like passion or addiction or whatever you want to call it, and I know that it's stupid. Like, I don't have this like emotional response to pretty much anything else in my life, except watching these 11 guys who probably don't even care as much as we do running around.
Of course not. But that's the devastating thing. That's the thing about loving a club. You have to love them, you know, at every level they're at. And it's sometimes so incredibly painful to do that. And it takes something in you to love a club, you know, with your whole heart and passion. And like that's what always, you know, gets to me about when you see boards not, you know, backing managers and your club, because as fans, we'd give every single penny we had, you know, to that club. We would. Like, we would do everything we could to make
that successful. Well, we do. I mean, as fans, we literally do, right?
You
know,
we
buy season tickets, we buy the kits, we, you know, turn up and spend money in the stadium. So, yeah.
You know, so, yeah.
Let's now talk about your all-time favourite Spurs shirt. Another one of my favourite questions, this. Tell me your favourites.
My favourite Spurs shirt from like when I was younger was the 94 kit. So it was actually, I mean, I was born in 94, so that was the first kit I probably ever got. Would love to know where that is. My mum probably binned it or something. I've got no iconic shirts from like my childhood. Only as I got older. Don't know where they are, don't know where the pictures are, nothing. Got no idea. I've asked multiple times and they've never been located. Or she's never even actually answered me when I've been like, Mom, where's that? So she's obviously been them when I was younger and thought I'd never want them, but you know. So yeah, the 94 kit, the Holston, it had like the blue trim on it, nice big Holston across the front of it.
I liked the Jürgen home shirt.
Yeah, the Jürgen, like the baggy, I love that whole look. So yeah, that's probably my favourite from when I was younger. As I got a bit older, weirdly, I think because of the connotations that came with it, I love the mansion shirt with the yellow trim. I think it was 2010.
So when we qualified for the Champions League, that's it.
Yeah, when we qualified for the Champions League, like there's so many good memories in that shirt, and like I associate it with like the Wigan game where we like beat them. Was it 9-1?
9-0. Did they score? Yeah. I can't remember now. Yeah.
They did. I think it was Paul. Was it Paul Sharner?
Paul Sharner. Yeah.
Paul Sharner. He had the
terrible goatee.
Yeah. Paul Sharner. It's weird how we remember things like that. So irrelevant. Yeah. So I just remember it from that. I remember it like from really good away days. I think we beat Arsenal in that kit, didn't we?
Balin.
Is that shirt? No, that wasn't that shirt. That was the autonomy. I think that was autonomy or asthma. The year after. That was the year after kit. But anyway, I remember like Bale resurgence in that type of kit.
That was Danny Rose scored his goal in that kit. Yeah.
That Arsenal game, Danny Rose, that game. I associate it with obviously like Peter Crouch, you know, Man City winner, that game. I always think of Wilson Palacios in that shirt. Weird. Don't know why, but I always do. And I love that shirt. I just always think back and I think actually that was a pretty cool shirt.
I'm getting that you enjoy Spurs home shirts with a bit of yellow on them.
Yeah, I do actually. I quite like them with a bit of yellow. I'm not really into this whole like new like night kits that's like look like, you know, a planet's exploded on them and things like that. Like,
You don't like the away shirt?
I've got it, but I don't really like it, honestly. Like, I like traditional kits. So like, I love our home shirt because it's just lily white, which is what I think it should be. I wish that AIA was navy. It'd be so much nicer. I think we all do. But I really hate our second and third kit. The only reason I like that hideous green-ish kit with the streets of Tottenham, I think, on it, or whatever it is, the map, was because of the Champions League run. Otherwise, I absolutely despised it. I would never, ever buy that kit, ever, if it wasn't for that. But I love, like, when we used to have, like, the yellow kit or, like, the dark navy or, like, the gold or the purple, like, but, like, the plain kits, you know, I think, like, just keep it classy. Don't need to, like, look like a planet's thrown up on you or, like, you've taken every bit off the cutting room floor and sewed it together and made a shirt. Like, I think that, you know, keeping it nice and fresh, that's why I love our home kit so much, because I'm like, yeah, okay, it's a bit boring, but we are. Like, we're just lily white. It doesn't have to have, like,
we are boring. Yeah.
We are boring. Like, it's just lily white. I like it. White shorts, white shirt, navy socks or white socks. You know, that I just like it to look like Spurs.
There you go. Nike, stop messing around. Now, this is probably the most detailed question we ask. Your Spurs heaven and your Spurs hell. So it doesn't have to be a specific game. It could be a certain period. It could be something around the signing of a favourite player, something to do with a manager, anything at all. And obviously the reverse for hell. So give me your Spurs heaven and your Spurs hell, please.
Spurs heaven.
When were you happiest as a Spurs fan?
When was I happiest? Probably like 2017-18. That was probably my happiest, like Pete Pochettino, and you know, consistently qualifying for the Champions League. You know, our team just dominating everywhere we went, like 6-0 at Hull, 6-0 at Southampton, here there, everywhere, just being incredible, like everyone working as a team, everyone with the same goal. That team we had, Walker, Rose, Jan, Toby, Dembele, I think Dyer was in there as well.
Wanyama,
Dele, Kane, who else was in there? Was Son in there?
Ericsson,
yeah. Son. Like that for me, like that was pure Tottenham. Everything about that, like the togetherness, the attacking football, just so attractive and fun to watch, and like just dominated teams was good. Like we had no soft underbelly, which we'd worked so hard for so many years and so many managers to try and get rid of. For me, yeah, that was probably my happiest. Also in that 3 week period after Ajax, between the Champions League final,
yeah,
that 3 weeks, literally like nothing could bring me down. I was like the happiest person on the planet.
I remember like allowing myself, like, I was like, I'm not going to worry about it. I'm just going to have like, because was it 3 or 4 weeks? It was a long time.
Yeah, after the Everton game, I think it was about 2.5, 3 weeks. Yeah.
I remember giving myself at least like a good fortnight where I was like, I'm not going to stress about the final. I'm just going to like soak it in. And that was bliss. It was absolutely perfect.
Like literally just live your best life for like 3 weeks and be like, yeah, everyone was like, oh, so what are you doing? I'm like, oh, what are you doing this week? And I'm like, nothing, just chilling for a Champions League final. Like just milking it for all it's worth. And obviously that was over very, very quickly. But that
very
was,
quickly.
I think the one of my best periods in my whole life, because I just was so happy every single day. It was sickening, actually.
I just loved how terrified like Arsenal fans in particular were, and I know that they obviously ended up not having to worry at all, but like just the terror that they had for that period that we might actually end up winning the Champions League was sort of worth, not it wasn't worth losing, but it was just so wonderful to talk to them. Yeah. You could tell they were just like, oh my God, what if they actually do this? Like,
they genuinely thought that we would do it as well. They genuinely thought that it would happen, and they probably should have known better that it wouldn't have happened, but still.
I mean, it will annoy me forever that they literally only had to worry for like 15 seconds. And then that was it.
And then it was over and that was it.
Then it was done.
My Spurs hell, we're still probably in it. I'm joking. My Spurs hell, I'd probably say Pochettino sacking. I really was very upset with that.
Mm.
I think a lot of the fan base were upset with it.
How were you with Mourinho when he sort of arrived? Did you find it difficult to get on board with him? Were you happy, pissed off?
I think I found it... I wouldn't say I liked Mourinho. I'd say that I didn't want Pochettino to go. So I think I struggled with accepting a new manager, especially when like Poch was so loved. I understand like about the results side of things, fair, but I think that I've got my own opinions on it, and I think that he probably should have had more investment and, you know, after the things that he got put through, you know, internally. I think that I wasn't not on board because I always back the manager to an extent. I just remember being at Norwich in the cup just before lockdown, the last game. And I remember it was so toxic and absolutely awful, that game. And I remember thinking, like, how can I back this manager? Like, you know, when you already see, he's barely been here and I can't get behind him. I think because of how much a lot of us love Pochettino, it was very difficult to suddenly just like love another manager, like especially with Jose as well, with all like the Chelsea ties. So I struggled with that. And then I think COVID helped him a lot.
Yeah.
COVID definitely helped him a lot. And then obviously the documentary came out. I was quite on board with him. I thought a new season, we'll give him a go. He seems, you know, very endearing in the documentary, obviously for the cameras, but blah, blah, blah. Gave him a go. And then I just kind of like, I think that I've got no issue with you calling out players. If they're not, you know, if they, I think a lot of our players sometimes need to be called out because, you know, they hide behind the manager a lot, I think. And you know, they have to take some credibility. So I don't have a problem with that. But I think when you solely blame, you know, that, you know, that's because of them, that's where I can't quite get behind it. It has to have like a shared blame, you know, between yourself, the board and the players. And I very quickly, you know, kind of went off the idea. I didn't care when he got sacked either way. The only thing I cared about was that I thought, well, horrendous timing, because actually the one person I would want in charge for a cup final would actually be Jose.
But
I didn't feel anything when he got sacked. I didn't care when Nuno got sacked or appointed, to be honest with you. I knew that was doomed from the start. So I kind of say, like, there's obviously been terrible moments in Spurs history, you know, painful ones like the Champions League final, losing multiple cup finals, semi-finals, things like that. Mid-table obscurity stuff, you know. But I'd say kind of like the last 2 years, I haven't enjoyed anything about Spurs. I really haven't. I haven't enjoyed the football. I haven't enjoyed the manager. I love Antonio Conte as a manager. So I'm obviously not putting him in that. But I think I haven't I'd say it's been quite hellish the last 2 years as a Spurs fan to see where we've been and where we are now. Mm. So I'd say that's probably the last 2 years has made me love football a little bit less as a fan, I'd say.
That links to the last question of our seven. Where are you with Spurs right now? And I'm hoping that I detect some sort of optimism creeping back in with Antonio, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's a fantastic manager. He's one of the top three managers on the planet, in my opinion.
Who are the other two?
Pep and Klopp for me. Yeah, mm-hmm. In no particular order.
Yeah.
But I think Antonio Conte is absolutely up there in that bracket. Don't know how we've managed to turn that around and get him in there. You know, incredible cooking from Paratici, I suspect. the king of the kitchen, it seems, at the moment, right? So I think he's a great manager. I think if anyone is going to do something with Spurs in terms of winning a trophy, I don't care if it's a Carabao Cup, an FA Cup, whatever it is, I don't care. Just someone has to win something. And I think that he's probably the only person on the planet that could do it at this point. I think that he has to get backing, like all the managers. And I don't mean typical Tottenham backing with 20 million here and 20 million there, you know, in the Dutch league and things like that. We know that doesn't work. He needs to be backed with Premier League proven quality, whether it means you go and spend, you know, 45, 50 million on someone like, I know, like a Basuma from Brighton. You know what you're going to get. You know what he's going to bring to the table. He's played in the Premier League before. You know, you go and get a centre-back or someone that's, you know, well-respected within Europe or something like that, and that's got pedigree. But I think it's very difficult in January when you're already involved in European competitions. Players don't want to leave in January. So I think the summer is really where the test is going to be and how much, you know, leverage he's given. But I'm hopeful that things can start going in the right direction. I think Spurs look better against Brentford. You know, we've had shots on target, which is great. We've got the win, we kept a clean sheet. I think something we haven't been able to do since August, if I'm right. I think it's going to take time because I think there's a lot of dead wood in that squad, which is still there from 2018, 2019. And that's the biggest problem, that they're still there. We only got rid of Danny Rose in the summer, hadn't played for 2 years.
Yeah.
So I think there's going to be a big emphasis on getting people out the door, whether or not that is to raise funds and things like that. The likes of Dele, maybe he'll keep Harry Winks, I don't know, Davinson Sanchez, Steven Bergwijn, amongst others. I think it's time to let those go. I think if they haven't worked after 2 years, and Ndombele, for me, I've kind of had enough of, you know, flying the flag for him. Should have actually mentioned him earlier. I've backed him so much, but with no response at all. Someone like him, it's just not going to work. So I think that's where I'm hopeful that I've kind of given up on this season. I know we're only 2 points off fourth at this point, which is mental to me. Just shows you how kind of crap everyone is from third spot down.
Seriously.
Really. I don't have like much expectation for this season. If we can, I'd rather focus on the cup games, to be honest with you, in the Carabao Cup, if we can beat West Ham, the FA Cup, if we can have a good run in that. I care more about that than the league, to be honest with you. Ideally, obviously, if we can stay up, you know, and within that race, fine, good for top four, but I don't believe that Spurs has scored good enough to play in Champions League football at the moment. I don't think they will do next year either. So, the attraction of being in that obviously brings a lot of money, but I don't know if Spurs would deserve to be in that.
I think what I'm sort of happy about is that I agree with you in that I think there's only one man almost on the planet who seems up for and capable of turning around this sort of ailing football club, and that does feel like Conte. And I think he seems to be happy and motivated to sort of put the entire club on his back, and not just the players, but I love the fact that he's sort of basically calling out the club in terms of, right, you've built this stadium, you've got this training ground. Arguably, you've done too much on that side and you've let everything else slip, and that's indefensible. You need to sort that out. Also, I think as a fan base, he's, you know, he's not calling us out, but I think he's doing his best to sort of ensure that we know that there's a responsibility that we have as fans, and that, you know, the stadium needs to become a fortress really for the first time, because we've never really had it at the new stadium, where we've had a decent enough team to actually feel like, you know, that place is a fortress. It's somewhere that teams are going to hate to come and play. It's been the opposite so far. I think teams love coming to our beautiful stadium and having a nice look around and meeting a really woeful Spurs team. So I think what I'm excited about is that we have this guy who seems to be, like I say, happy to just like right, I am the guy that is going to inject this club with the passion, the expertise, the, you know, the experience. I'm actually qualified to do it. I'm not Nuno. I'm not, you know, someone that's, this job is not suitable for them in any way. I'm not Jose, where it just was never a good fit. This feels like a marriage that could work out, whether or not it does. And, you know, Christ knows what will happen in transfer windows. And he's obviously going to very soon understand what the realities actually are in terms of what we can spend, etc. And you'd hope that there's no, you know, broken promises made, etc. But it is lovely to have someone that you feel like you can get behind again, because
100%.
We haven't had that since Poch at all.
Agreed. Totally agree. Hopefully there's no broken promises, because I think that we'll know about it if there are.
Yeah, exactly. And that's sort of, you know, it's terrifying / exciting, I think, because, you know, I think I have certainly felt like Jose was going to be someone that would gladly call out the club if they didn't, you know, sign him this player or that. And it never seemed to actually, you know, sort of seemed to toe the party line quite a lot. Whereas with Conte, yeah, if he doesn't get, you know, his wing back of choice come January or whatever, then we're going to know about it pretty quickly.
But, I know.
Yeah, fingers crossed. Right, there is one more question for you before we finish. We ask everyone this. Can we please get a culture recommendation from you, Abby? So an album, a film, a TV show, a book, an exhibition, a restaurant, anything recently that you've loved. What can you tell us?
I'm so incredibly uncultured. so incredibly uncultured. I barely watch TV, and when I do, it's on a, like, reality-based, which is so awful. I haven't started reading it yet, but the Glenn Hoddle book. It's on my bedside table, and I'm waiting for a time over Christmas where I actually have some time to spare and I can actually read it and concentrate and get into it. So I guess it's a recommendation that I haven't actually explored yet, but that's where I'm at. I'm excited to read the Glenn Hoddle book, and I suspect everyone listening to this podcast, if they haven't already read it or purchased it, I think it'll be on a lot of people's Christmas wish list because of such an iconic, amazing, God-like player. I think we'll all be well on board with wanting to read that.
And you mentioned reality TV. What's your sort of go-to Sunday afternoon? Just turn on something to switch off.
Oh, I love cooking shows. So I love, like, MasterChef. I love Gordon Ramsay, Kitchen Nightmares, Hell's Kitchen. Love things like that. At the moment, I'm watching Love Island Australia.
Okay.
Much to people's dismay that I live with. Because as soon as I have, like, a spare hour, I'm like, Love Island's going on. And they're like, no. But yeah, Love Island Australia. It's just, I don't have time at the moment to, like, get into stuff, like, deeply. I've been watching Ted Lasso for about 4 weeks now, and there's only, like, 10 episodes. Oh, that's a really cute cat.
Yeah, she's my cat, Ruby.
I couldn't even ignore her. She was too cute. Yeah, I've been watching Ted Lasso, but because I keep watching, like, one every week or 2 weeks, I feel a bit disjointed from it. But that is a good series. If anyone hasn't seen it, that's on Apple TV.
You should definitely stick with it. It's incredible. I think you'd love it. All right. Well, we'll check back in for your actual review of Glenn's book and hopefully some Ted Lasso chat as well next time we have you on. But Abby, that was fantastic. Thank you so much for your time and your honest answers. Really, really interesting and a fantastic guest. So thank you so much. We really appreciate your time. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me. I look forward to being back with you soon.
Excellent. All right. Thank you ever so much. Cheers. You've been listening to a very special episode of Hometown Glory with Abby Summers. Thank you for listening.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.